This is The Gay Life on KSAN, and I'm Randy Alfred. During the show this morning, we'll talk with Bob Barnes and Robert Barnes, Jr., a father and son, both involved in San Francisco politics. We'll also hear about what San Francisco schools are doing about gay lifestyles education. But first, we have here this morning Larry Kramer, the author of the controversial novel Faggots. Good morning, Larry.
Good morning, Randy.
You chuckled a little when I called it controversial. You've apparently taken quite a bit of flack about it. I want to say, first of all, that my friends may think it's politically incorrect, but I enjoyed it.
Thank you very much. I thought it was lots of fun.
I
would just like somebody to say, introduce me as being other than controversial. However,
it seems to be that the paperback, which is just out, is being promoted on the basis of its being controversial.
That's evidently what sells books. To get the message to Garcia, huh?
Well, what people in the gay movement find controversial, I think, is a public discussion of some of the seamier aspects of our sexuality.
Of just the honest aspects of our sexuality. Forget the seamy. Seamy is all in the mind of the beholder.
Who is the book intended for?
I have no idea. I wrote it myself. I don't know who my audience was. I don't think writers really do know. They write it for themselves and to find out what they're thinking about and find out about themselves and try to make some sense out of life and hope that some other people will share that experience with them.
Who has the audience become?
I don't know. It seems to be selling very well. The hardcover did extraordinarily well. And the paperback is just out and seems to be off to a nice start. So I suspect it's being read by a lot of different people. I'm always amazed sometimes when you go in bookstores and they tell you that it's little old ladies who are buying it. But
well, I had this experience last autumn after the assassination of Harvey Milk. Reverend Bill Barkus called for...
A good friend of mine.
Called for a national day of coming out
right,
to be
I remember.
Held on the following right. Sunday. And there were several people in my family, cousins and aunts and uncles, who I'd always felt close to in the past. And although I'd come out to my parents, they had said, well, but don't come out to the family, blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, this is it. I've got to come out to these people, to be honest. And called my cousins in New York, who, as it turns out, are acquainted with you through
They sell New York. Me my insurance.
Social circles, and came out. My cousin Laurel, who was my first crush. I mean, she was when I was around four, and she was 15 or something. I had my crush on my cousin Laurel. Well, she said she was reading this book at the time.
And, oh, right, yeah. Probably through my sister-in-law. Yeah.
And she said, I guess it was, she thought it was okay for me to be gay, but she wanted assurances that I was a respectable gay person and not like some of the characters in the book.
Or, like she is living in Larchmont or Scarsdale or wherever she is.
Right. Now, this obviously upsets the image that's set up in novels such as, I can't even remember the name of it, Laura Hobson's one about
consenting adults.
Consenting adults, about in which the gay characters are just like everybody else except
right.
for what they do in bed.
Right. That book made me so angry because... It didn't make me angry. I was happy it came out, and my mother got a charge out of it. I guess I felt that she wasn't very honest in developing particularly the role of the father, her husband, however.
But you are obviously not an apostle of gay respectability.
Oh, come on now. What's that mean?
The image of we're exactly like everybody else. I'm not saying...
I think we are just like everybody else.
And except for what we do in bed? Most of the sex in your book doesn't even take place in bed.
What's that got to do with it? I mean, I think that the one thing I've come to really feel is that the problems of gays and the problems of straights, particularly vis-a-vis relationships and sexuality and fidelity and love, are exactly the same as they are with gays.
Okay, I'll grant you that. And I think I reacted to the book in a number of ways. I reacted to the humor. There are parts of it where... It kind of goes off into the absurdist by way of exaggeration.
Hyperbole, yeah.
Hyperbole. And that humor, I think, is very enlightening about who we are and about the human condition in general. And there are some of the very strongly introspective parts with which, coming from a very similar cultural milieu to your own, I can identify very strongly. Same religious background.
Your basic Jewish fetch.
Right. Basic... basic gay Jewish Yalik fetch.
Right.
So that there are all of these intellectual overtones going on that strike the chords. And found some of it almost to verge on the painful in that it was too close to my own experience and going through this and thinking, oh my God, he's 10 years older than me. He's still going through the same stuff.
And doesn't get any easier as you get older, you
it's
know.
It's not resolved yet in that sense at all. But the outward action of the book, the plot, as it were, against which all of this is going, which has some startling resemblances to Mozart opera in terms of unlikely juxtapositions of people getting put in the same place.
What a nice comparison.
is very raunchy. I mean, it's about sex in the piers and sex in clubs with names like the Toilet Bowl and the Disco Life and the Meat Racket Fire Island. And
there are a few intimate bedroom scenes within the confines of private homes.
Okay.
Is there anything in what you've mentioned that doesn't exist?
No, I don't think there is. The book is obviously not written to be the kind of nice, soft-lighted public relations for the gay movement, which
it's a work of fiction. It's a novel. It's not meant to be public relations. And God forbid someone should write a book about public relations. That's dishonest.
Where has most of the criticism come from? Has it been from political gay people?
I think mostly from the activists, a small number of very vocal people. I got to tell you that I've received more mail than any Random House author ever received, and I didn't get one negative letter. It was all positive. Everyone saying thank you. Thank you for at last writing an honest book about what we're really going through. And a lot of it's come from straights, too, saying I have much more understanding of what my gay friends are going through. Also, I've seen some parallels with my own life. That's very heartwarming. I happen to believe very firmly that unless you investigate everything strongly and intelligently, not sweep things under the carpet, you're not going to be taken seriously. It's those public relations, sunshine and light, movies of the 40s type novels where everybody walks off happily hand in hand in the sunset, which do more danger. I think Anita Bryan did us more good than harm. I think this cruising business, the movie in New York, I don't think it can hurt us. I think what hurts us is what's going on and trying to protest against it. It's only going to make the movie even more successful.
Now the protagonist of your book is one of the things that's developing. He's trying to interest a producer in making a film, which seems as if it would be a lot like what the cruising thing that's going on in New York is like.
That was a very minor subplot. carry on.
One thing that throughout the book, the people in the book don't seem to know even one person who is involved politically in the gay movement. There isn't even an activist character as a token activist. Are there, in fact, circles where people are just totally unaware of
I'm writing about New York. I'm writing about a very specific group of people. The people who are successful, moneyed, whatever you want to call it, the upper classes, if you will.
Right, they also are all moneyed.
And the people who should be role models and aren't. The people who should be gay activists and aren't. I don't know if you're aware, but political scene in New York is a mess in terms of gay activism. It's a very disorganized city. We're supposed to have over 1 million homosexuals, most of whom can't be seen. You're quite right. There aren't any gay activists in the novel because there are very few gay activists in the city that move in this circle.
Okay. In your book, you say, of the 2,639,857 faggots in New York City, in the New York City area, 2,639,857 think primarily with their cocks.
I did.
That doesn't leave any room for anyone who doesn't. Do you really feel that that's universal?
we go back to the hyperbole of the style. It's a comic novel. I do think that one of the problems that we're going through now is that we treat ourselves almost exclusively as sexual beings. And while I think sex is fine, and I'm not promulgating that we don't do what we want to do, I think we've come to look upon ourselves strictly in sexual terms, treating each other as only as sexual objects. And I do think that has gotten out of hand, and that's primarily why there's so much sex in the book. I just wanted to ram that point home.
Do you...
Having said that, I am not advocating any kind of legislation against it or whatever, as some people think. I'm only saying that when you do this, when we do treat each other so callously, that there are problems involved. And one of the problems is that relationships are very difficult to sustain, and a community has great difficulty in taking itself seriously, and a lot of people who might like to come out and be active won't come out and be active because they don't want to be affiliated with those kind of rights, those kind of priorities. It is a difficult problem because what distinguishes us from other men is our sexuality. On the other hand, what I've said, I think it can be blown out of proportion and do us a lot of damage.
Okay, well, as I went through the book, I had a sense in some points of saying, oh, I wish she hadn't written about that.
Why?
Just that one part, because there are all these straight people who won't understand the context of it. But then I think you do a very good job of putting it.
Why do you worry so much about what straight people are going to think? Why don't you just worry about what you think? And why doesn't every homosexual just take care of himself and not be so frightened about what they are going to think? We oppress ourselves far more than they oppress us. That's another realization that I've come to. We're our own worst enemies.
Okay, I'll take that as criticism, but I you didn't let me put it in my context of saying,
go right ahead.
There were those parts where I thought, you know, maybe this is gets too much into the hyperbole. I'm not sure that everyone who reads this would understand it and so forth.
But it's only important that you understand it. So I'm talking to you. It's your shame that is talking. It is your guilt that is talking. And that's the most insidious, dangerous thing. And you have to cope with that. If you're doing something that you're ashamed of or you're guilty of.
Well, yeah, except the things that I'm guilty of or feel guilty about mm-hmm. are not the ones that are going to be identified by the people who I'm afraid of misreading. And I'm not advocating saying that you shouldn't have said those things or stuff. But just like my own immediate reaction of thinking, oh, he's revealing too much there, just as a question of taste. The things that, in fact, I feel guilt about are not the behaviors in terms of who's sticking what into whom with what, with who looking and where and that, mm-hmm. but the way people treat each other.
Exactly.
And that's the part that I was getting to next was the pain.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the pain is kind of only alleviated by the fact that when it gets real tight, you usually get it off with the humor. And, mm-hmm. you know, and there's just lots of good chuckles and belly laughs and ha-has. And wanting to, you know, to reread the passage to whoever's, you know, sitting there in the room with you or whatever. But still, at the end, having elucidated all these problems and having done it in ways, because it's so close, that are painful,
good.
You really don't offer the way out.
I certainly don't. I don't know the way out. And I'm not here to solve everybody's problems. I'm just here to pose the questions. I don't know that there are any answers. I'm just saying, this is how I think it is, and these are the problems that if you do X, this is probably what's going to happen at Y. And it's up to you to decide what you want to do with it. There are responsibilities in life. There are responsibilities in relationships. No one said it was easy. But if you are going to attempt to have a relationship, then you really can't do this and that and the other thing and expect the relationship to work.
Okay. If there's no way out...
I didn't say there was no way out. I just
said... Or if you're not going to show the way out...
I can only show the way out for me, or
okay,
I can only attempt to work
right,
it out for
what
myself.
What comes next for you? What project are you working on now? What do you do after writing a novel?
Like faggots. Well, I'm going to continue the story. My next novel will have some of the same characters in it, but will basically concern the heterosexual people who are related to the homosexual people in this book. And I hope to show that our problems are very similar. I'm first going off to Australia to do another D.H. Lawrence film of Kangaroo, which is set in Australia. But I'll get back to the next book when I come back.
Okay, this is The Gay Life on KSAN, and we've been talking to Larry Kramer, author of Faggots, which has just been released into a Warner Brothers paperback. Thank you for being here this morning.
Thank you very much.
Our next guest this morning on The Gay Life on KSAN are Bob Barnes, a retired machinist union official and labor liaison for San Francisco District 8 Supervisor Don Haranzi, and his son, Robert Barnes Jr., a gay activist and the campaign manager for Howard Wallace, a supervisorial candidate in San Francisco's District 5. Good morning, Bob. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning, Randy.
Good morning, Randy.
This is the first time I've done a father-son interview, and it's also significant in that it is your 20th birthday, Robert, so happy birthday as well as good morning.
Thank you.
You've both wound up in politics. How did that happen?
We are longtime San Franciscans. Our great-grandfather came here in the 1860s and was a sergeant at Alcatraz in the artillery, Irish, and they settled here in San Francisco. Family lived through the earthquake, and there's still two survivors left in the family from the earthquake. And we've just always been involved in politics. My father was a labor leader in he was in the general strike in the 30s and was labor leader in the machinist union in the 40s and 50s until his retirement. And we've just, politics has been part of our life.
Well, with me, politics started when my father decided that he was going to run against Dan White and a number of other people in District 8 for supervisor. He decided he was going to run for supervisor, so I decided that...
That was in 1977.
That was in 1977.
Were you old enough to vote then?
That was my first election. My first election was when I voted for my father for supervisor. I was just turning 18 that August before the November, and I was going to school before then. I'd always been interested, as my father said. I was, all my life, I can remember at 2 o'clock in the morning, labor union arguments going on in the kitchen while I was trying to sleep.
The anti-war marches.
We have pictures of being in the whole family spending the afternoon on an anti-war march, and it was a good, strong influence, so I decided to...
The early farm worker struggle, the family was always on the picket lines or in the marches. And even we used to take them in strollers.
There's a pretty conservative picture that most people have of what District 8 is like.
District 8 in San Francisco is a swing district. There seems to be five very liberal districts, and there seems to be five very conservative districts. 8 is the swing. It's District 8's vote brought about district elections. It broke the ties. And there is no... consistency. It is not conservative. It's not liberal. They'll take, in 76, they voted in support of the farm workers, yet overwhelmingly voted for Gerry Ford. We ran it through the computer at the time in 77, and we could not come out with a consistent liberal or conservative because the votes by issue, and they swing. District 8 is a district in San Francisco that has 98% single-family dwellings. It's the most stable community in San Francisco. As I said, my people moved in there after the 1906 earthquake, and we're still there. And families upon family, it's just, you just stay there. It's an unusual place, and politically, there is no label you can put on it.
Is it a working class district?
Oh, yes. It's the highest percentage of blue-collar workers in San Francisco. It's the highest as blue-collar union families. But again, you can't put them into a bag of one way or the other.
Well, when I was working in the No on Six campaign, I was working with BACABI, which was the Bay Area Committee Against the Briggs Initiative at the time. And I met with Dan White. I sat in his office, and he wrote me a check for $100 and donated it to the BACABI campaign. So with Proposition 6, even people like Dan White were coming out against Proposition 6. But I would believe some of the most reactionary precincts in the district were there because Dan White ran on a law and order platform. I mean, he made people frightened about going out in the streets, and he was going to protect them. He was a policeman and he was a firefighter, and
again, you must remember that Dan only won on 28% of the vote out there. There was no overwhelming mandate from the people. But again, District 8, a year ago, a sit-in ended that the longest sit-in ever held in the United States was held out in District 8. For 43 days, we held Alamany Emergency Hospital, actually operated it, people from the community. I lived there for 43 days. When Proposition 13 passed and the city was going to close down the emergency hospitals in San Francisco, we went on the night of the closure, took it over, tore the signs off the door that said it was closed, reopened the doors, went in there for 43 days, ran a hospital. I think that's probably one of the most revolutionary things that happened in San Francisco. We actually took over city property and ran it for, as I said, 43 days, but we did it in such a way that they could never come down on us. We ran it better than the city was running it.
No, it's as if Robert has followed your footsteps into politics. Had you ever wanted him to follow your footsteps into the work of the Machinist Union?
No, he's not a mechanical person, and I realize that.
I was if I can interject here, I was a machinist for one day when I was a teenager. My father got me a job. It was a very good paying job. It wasn't difficult, but I just, my skills are those of communication and being able to deal with people and what comes to using my hands. And as far as being a laborer, I could if I had to, but I prefer to use the skills that I feel that I do have naturally instead of building those skills.
Bob, I'm very proud of what he does. As you said, today's his birthday. He's 20 today, and him and I have had our ups and downs, but as a family, we survive. He is a vowed gay person. I'm not, being a father of three and married 21 years. But again, that's his private business, and the family's the family, and whatever, where he goes, we support him and follow him, but he supports us in what we do. But we're opposite on many. I mean, if you want to get into it, him and I, in the elections coming up, we're dead opposites.
How's that? Who are you supporting for mayor?
I'm endorsing Feinstein.
And at this point, I'm not supporting anyone, but I'm leaning towards David Scott.
And have you discussed that with each other?
Oh, yeah. Have we discussed that with each other?
For sure. We go down Arlo Smith for DA, and
I'm supporting Carol Ruth Silver. I mean, it's right down the line. I guess, though we follow the same general direction as far as liberal politics go, when it comes to, I think, on issues, pretty much that we agree, and I was, as I say, as we've pointed out here, I've been raised with a liberal background, with a union base, and that was the basis of what I am politically now. And basically on issues, I think that we feel pretty much the same.
But we should say that it was the same way when I was very active in the union. We'd lock in a room with the executive board and fight like cats and dogs, but then walk out across the street and have a drink together. It's the same with Bob and I. We'll fight like cats and dogs, but don't step on either of us because we'll both defend one another.
You're working in different districts, though. Have either of you ever traded on the reputation or the name recognition or the clout of the other? Has it ever been useful to you, Bob, to have a gay activist son elsewhere in the city? And has it ever been useful to you, Robert, to have a labor leader father active elsewhere in the city?
It probably hurt me more in the election. I can't say I came out of the closet. I took my son out of the closet during the election. and stated before, I believe it was Alice B. Toklas at the time, that in District 8 you wouldn't find a gay candidate, but I was the parent of a gay individual, and I never hid the fact nor put it down. No.
Did you get the endorsement of Alice B. Toklas?
No one got the endorsement. I got you needed 58% of the votes that day, and I think I got 56%. No one got it.
But he did have the endorsement of the BAR newspaper.
Oh, and the Gay Democratic Club and such.
Okay, but you think that might have hurt when the word got back to District 8, possibly?
Well, yes. It was – the election in District 8 was a vicious election. Nobody knew the extent that it went. Vicious things were happening. I was never able to keep a sign up for 10 minutes in the district. Well, there used to be a Volkswagen. I won't say that Dan sent him out, but his campaign certainly did. That would follow our people. As soon as we hung signs up, they'd tear them down. It got very vicious. There was some confrontations. It was never reported. I should say that we were very naive in that election, in that we thought it would be democratic and everybody would be fair, and didn't get into the dirty tricks and use the things we could have used. Consequently, White won and changed the whole political situation in Northern California.
Yeah. What about you, Robert?
Well, go ahead.
Have you ever had use of your father's name, and has it been important?
It certainly has. In terms of, I mean, as we've mentioned today, I'm 20 years old, and there's a lot of ageism out there in the political world, and they're not. You know, up until today, I've been a teenager, and they're not likely to take somebody that, like myself, seriously. So to have the name and the background has gotten me into a lot of doors politically. To have the Barnes name, I mean, I'm a fifth-generation San Franciscan. My family has been involved in San Francisco politics. I had an uncle that owned downtown and lost it gambling years ago. I mean, he owned...
Let's be honest, he owned a whorehouse in the International Settlement. Harry Connema was his name. He was the first one-armed ball player. He's also the first man with one arm to swim the distance of which is now the Golden Gate Bridge. Quite a during the Irish Mafia, there was a lot of clout in this town. The other side of the family is Crowley and Connema, plus the Barnes has been here a long time.
Yeah, and having a father who's politically known in the labor movement, which is a left-wing movement that is very much associated with my politics, has opened many doors for me, and I think it will continue to open doors for me. I think that my name, people know who I am, people know where I come from, and people accept me politically, at least those people that are on the left side of the political spectrum where I consider myself.
In 1978, when Dan White resigned, and there was that couple of weeks of jockeying and lobbying over who would be appointed or whether or not White would be reappointed, did either of you play any part in?
Yes, I was. Matter of fact, I and members of the community had the last meeting with Moscone before the Monday of the assassination, where George was told, quite frankly, that these 25 people in this room that we had this meeting with him, that if he reappointed Dan, we weren't telling him who to appoint. I never came out and supported anyone for the job, but we told him if he reappointed Dan White, not to come out into our neighborhood to campaign ever again. He made his decision that night in front of us and told us that it wasn't going to happen, that... politically, Dan White had received an F in if he was to give him a grade in smarts, political smarts, that if he was smart, he would have went to the mayor and said, I'm going to resign 2 weeks, give the mayor some time to get an appointment together. But White turned his own people against him by resigning without talking to anybody, because we were able to unite myself, all the people that had run for office, plus the White people, to put up a block in opposition to him. I was sniping at White within 3 months after he was in office when I found out that his campaign disclosures weren't even signed, and he had, if you went into City Hall, they have a record files for all the 1977 campaigns, and we pulled out Dan White, and it showed contributions. And then we went to the next drawer, and we pulled out Bank of America and found that they had contributed. Dan did not declare that. Metro Media had contributed. Dan did not declare that.
I might add here that they're the owners of this station.
Well, they declared it. White
right.
didn't.
Okay.
That's how we found out that Foster and Kleiser, the signboard people, had made must have been in-kind donations, because there were 7 or 8 great big signboards up in our neighborhood that were never reported on Dan White's political disclosures.
This is the Law and Order candidate, then.
The Law and Order candidate. And the day after we went to City Hall and went to the DA's office, to Timothy Stone, who may be familiar with People's Temple.
Right.
I'd like to bring that together later.
He was the district attorney who was in charge of the People's Temple voter fraud investigation.
Voter fraud that 3 times
he had been a former member of the People's Temple himself.
And 3 times he had cleared Dan White of political. Dan was allowed the next day to resubmit his disclosures, which was by Proposition 9 that was passed. This was an out-and-out felony. Neither he nor his treasurer had signed the reports. They just sent them in, not signed. They were allowed to resubmit them using the data that we had found, putting it into the new report, and then, of course, Stone said, well, you know, that Dan was just naive. It was naive from the beginning, you know, that everything he had done. He didn't live in the district. He had continued to live outside the district for 2 months after the election. Lived at out by Lake Merced. They changed addresses with his sister. Dan White was living in a house that had 27 people registered out of it.
Were any of the other ones police officers?
No, it was family. You know, we thought that as a single family dwelling, that the health department should have came in, and you know, there's only one toilet in there, 27 people living. This was on London Street. This again is in the records. If you take out the voter registration.
Right.
You would find 27 people living in one house.
So all of this was brought up to the mayor.
No, it was brought up to the DA.
No, but and the DA didn't do anything.
Never did anything.
Okay, but then it was brought again to Mayor Moscone when the question of Dan White's reappointment came up.
We just said we couldn't live with him. We didn't want him to represent us. He didn't. I put in a thing to recall him and got a letter from Dan White saying, "You voted for me. Why are you doing this?" I mean, I voted for him. I was running against him. It was, hey, he had some weird people behind him.
Okay. Robert, what happened when Dan White resigned? What did you do?
When Dan White resigned, I immediately, my first reaction was, oh, thank God, we've got to get a liberal in that seat.
Now, this was
But
this was within a couple of days after Proposition 6 had gone down to defeat. He had given your organization a $100 check.
That didn't matter. I mean, Ronald Reagan came out against Proposition 6. I'm still not going to support Ronald Reagan for anything.
Okay.
So that didn't cut much cake with me. Everybody came out against Proposition 6 weeks before the election. So what I did was he resigned. So I looked back at the community that I'd been raised in and who were some of the community leaders. My fear was that the person most likely to get appointed to the seat was that the man that came in second to Dan White, who was mounting a strong campaign for the appointment to the seat, Len Hines, who, as I said earlier, is just as right-wing and just as anti-gay, in my opinion. This is my personal opinion. Well, the woman that came in third in that race was a woman by the name of Helen Fama, a political moderate who is also a feminist. She's involved with National Women's Political Caucus. And so I met with a group of gay leaders and formed a telegram, organized this, and then met with Supervisor Harvey Milk at the time. And I got a commitment from Supervisor Harvey Milk to push for the appointment of Helen Fama for the Board of Supervisors.
Okay, now Helen Fama came in third.
Yes.
And Bob Barnes came in fourth?
Yeah.
How is it that you weren't supporting your father for supervisor?
Well,
how is it
one,
that you weren't putting yourself forward?
I had just, Proposition 13 had just passed in the state. San Francisco voted against it. But I felt that the mayor taking, at the time, a declaration of emergency was passed, where he took all the power, and the Board of Supervisors knee-jerked with Prop 13, closing the emergency hospitals, cutting back when the people of San Francisco had stood up and said, hey, we don't want these kind of cuts. The only place in the state. And I mounted a recall campaign against Moscone. So I didn't think there was much chance of me getting anywhere.
Exactly. And I didn't – that. And I had known about all of this, and I didn't think that knowing that my father's relationship with Moscone, it was kind of fruitless to put my energy into getting someone appointed. As it turned out, Moscone thought that it was more politically wise to appoint somebody that wasn't involved in the race at all.
And he made a good choice in Supervisor Renzi.
For whom you were working.
Who after the election, right. After his appointment, we sat down and I had met the man, and I am his representative on the Manpower Council, well, Employment and Training Council, they changed the name. And I like the man, and I think he's a good, fair a supervisor, and he's good for our district.
We're talking on The Gay Life to Bob Barnes, a labor leader from District 8, and his son, Robert Barnes Jr., a gay activist and a political force in District 5. Robert, you're managing the campaign of Howard Wallace, who is a gay activist with a lot of history in the labor movement. Doesn't that kind of bring together the whole family history of politics in the Barnes family?
It certainly does. As I say, my labor, as we discussed earlier, my labor background has moved me towards this person that's not only a gay activist, but has a long history as a labor activist as well. The reason that I'm supporting this man, Howard Wallace, against the incumbent supervisor, Harry Britt, is within our gay community in District 5 and citywide, for that matter, there have been, since the assassination of Supervisor Harvey Milk, there have been some serious splits in the community, as we all lobbied behind Ann Cronenberg to get appointed to the seat in District 5, and Dianne Feinstein didn't want somebody too young and too uncontrollable that she didn't have very much control over in the seat.
Hold on just a moment now. Bob, you're supporting Feinstein, and you've got a son who's active in politics and who's maybe 4 or 5 years younger than Ann Cronenberg. Do you think that Feinstein's reasons for not appointing a young woman were valid?
I don't know. I do know that at the time, Ann didn't live in the district. She lived a few blocks outside of District 5. I think that might have had something to do with it. I don't think she made a wise appointment in what she did. I don't like Britt, and I support Bob as candidate Howard Wallace.
Aha, so Robert, you did get your father's endorsement for your candidate.
Oh, you better believe it.
You don't disagree on everything.
Oh, no, we don't disagree on everything.
No, it's just that you were talking about the top of the ticket, and you disagreed on the mayor, you disagreed on who you were supporting for district attorney as well.
Oh, yeah. Endorsement in this town with district elections doesn't mean a hell of a lot anymore. Where you get the votes, and I learned that. I sat back with the Democratic Party endorsement, the labor movement endorsement, AFL-CIO, longshoremen, down the line. Matter of fact, in District 8, no other candidate got an endorsement citywide. I got them all, or no one got them. And there was two places where they were split. But they don't mean anything in an election in district.
So you don't think it's a labor town anymore?
Oh, no. I'm sad to say. I believe in a labor town that isn't here anymore. The working people in San Francisco, the old-timers have all moved out. We have no industry in this town. It's basically a tourist white-collar town. The people commute in. They have no political base.
Well, I would take point with that. I think that labor has been under constant attack in this. The labor movement has been under constant attack by people like Dianne Feinstein in this town for years and years now. And I think I find the labor bureaucrats are the ones that all that labor, all what they're doing is they're giving people money. Now they're turning into another moneyed machine. The COPE endorsement. You seek the COPE endorsement because you'll get money from labor. They're not, what these candidates aren't doing, and what my candidate, Howard Wallace, is doing, is he's going after rank and file. Those are the people that live in the city and are just rank and file workers. Those are the ones you have to go after. You can forget about the bureaucrats because you're either going to get their money or you're not, but they're not going to produce the votes for you. And I think that's what my father said.
I agree with Bob in his analogy. That's what I was saying.
Including that Feinstein's been going after the unions?
Oh.
What's that?
He said at the beginning that Feinstein's been going after the unions. Do you agree with that part of it, too? Because you're endorsing Feinstein.
Well, Feinstein's record is one that when she was first ran for supervisor, the labor movement very much supported her.
So did the gay movement, I might add, when she first ran for supervisor.
And back in 76, we got a dirty deal. Feinstein, Christ, she came about because of assassinations. I mean, where I'm at right now, I think that she did do where I supported her was the night of the, maybe Bob won't go along with this, the night of the riots. I felt that if she had overreacted, and I think that her and Gaines did a good job in containing the situation instead of going in there and making it into a bloodbath. And I've seen a little more hope in her than anyone else that's running for mayor in San Francisco. I'm not saying that, the last elections since John F. Kennedy has been, I'm talking state, federal, local, is not who's the lesser of the evils. And Quentin Cobb is not my cup of tea, nor I don't find Scott to be a strong candidate, and I think I'd be voting for him would be giving a vote towards Quentin Cobb.
I'd just like, at this point, I'd like to quote Mark Twain when he said, when you vote for the lesser of two evils, you still get an evil, and that's how I see Dianne Feinstein. I still have vivid pictures of her during the city strike, crossing the hospital picket lines to make the beds in defiance of the strikers. She has a total anti... I don't want to get on a tangent against Dianne
Feinstein. But what we have here is the son taking his labor leader father to task for supporting a candidate whom the son perceives as anti-labor.
Among other things.
Getting back to social change, of it not being a labor union town anymore and probably not being an Irish town in the way it used to be, Charles McCabe has made a lot of what he calls a gay invasion. And I suspect that the two of you have had some discussion over his recent set of columns. Or what do you think of his analysis of what's going on in San Francisco?
I think that he's inciting, and I think that he wants a backlash. I think that he's trying to create a backlash that isn't there. I think that I was totally offended by his column. I thought telling people that towards the end of the week, he was telling people that they should be proud to go back into the closet, that now that we're in the place where we're at, that the closet should be a proud place for us to be, that we've gotten our acceptance, what more than we want. What I want as a gay person is all that I want as a gay person is to be, I don't want to go out on the street and be afraid of being beat up by a bunch of punks, or when I report it to the police, being beat up by them. I mean, I don't want to go out, I don't want to be discriminated against in some cities. I'm in San Francisco, and obviously in housing and employment, the discrimination isn't to the level that it is in other places, but there have been votes across this country. We can't just look at it in terms of San Francisco. Across this country, Miami, Eugene, Oregon, all the other places where we've lost the elections, where gay people are discriminated against in housing and in employment. We're citizens of this country. In San Francisco, I think that it's because of the gay community that San Francisco now is the city that it is. I mean, is the strong, vital city, liberal, vital city of the West that it is. I think a lot of people look at San Francisco for strength. I attribute that largely to the gay community. And I just think that people like McCabe are trying to create a backlash that isn't there, that isn't really there. I think most people understood why we rioted on the night of May 21st. I think most people, even most straight people, could feel the same feelings that I felt, you know, of total wondering our judicial system in this country, you know, wondering, you know, what is justice? You know, we want justice. It's not there. I mean, I think anybody could see that. You don't have to be gay to see that, that justice was not done in the Dan White case.
Bob?
Yes, I feel that human rights transcend sexual orientation. That's why I can come out and I work tables for Proposition 6. I've walked in stuffed mail boxes and any social law that would restrict anybody is wrong, and you have to fight it. I think McKay touched a nerve that in a lot of the city is there. I'm offended quite often when I go to gay rallies when someone up on stage says, stop acting like a heterosexual, such as supervisors from District 5 squealed that night, you know, stop acting like heterosexuals. Let's stop going into camps. And we are isolating ourselves, the gay community. Soon I expect to see walls going up there. I can condone what McKay was trying to say. I was reading it with different eyes than Bob read it with, of course. And
you said what he was trying to say. I mean, you don't think he said what he was trying to say?
What he was saying, what I read, and I read the five articles, and that he was saying this was becoming a mecca, a place where a magnet for gay people. Fine, that there's always been gay people in San Francisco. When I was a kid, this was the gay center of the United States. Except gay was a different word then. It was, the faggots were there or the queers or whatever. And even at that time, and I'm 38 years old right now, and I was raised in the 50s, high school in 1956 and such. And even then it was the same thing that is today. Let's go roll a queer. We're looking for some money. You know, it existed and it exists today. And that's wrong, you know. But I was to the fair Sunday, and there were segments of it that offended me. I was with my daughter, and I was offended by
at the
Castro Street Fair by I don't think it's right to flaunt your sexuality.
What was it that was offensive? What was the flaunting?
Well, people. How can I put this without sounding like guys playing with each other in the street?
Were they doing anything that if a straight couple were doing it wouldn't have been just called
It'd been just as offensive. It wasn't wholesome affection. I mean, people holding hands, people hugging each other, people kissing each other. I don't find that to be offensive. I find when some guy sticks his hand in someone else's pants in public, it becomes offensive when you're walking with your children. These things, and it's not the community. Most of the people out there were neat. You know, it was a happy time. But there's segments that you focus on. And they, us people that from... call it the rural part of San Francisco that come down to the sophisticated center of the city, it offends us to walk by and see some guy with his ass chopped out of his pants hanging out. That offends me. I don't see it to be cool or to be a political demonstration. It's just tacky.
Robert's squirming here.
Yes, I take point with that. First, I'd like to say at the Castro Street Fair, I had one of the best times I've ever had in my life. And the Gay Freedom Day Parade, the Castro Street Fair, many of the gay-oriented demonstrations, you know, have been some of the most powerful and have had some of the most important impacts on my life. Personally, I get offended every time some straight person tells me that I have to fall into a mold of theirs, into a stereotype of theirs, and that I can't be effeminate if I want to be, that I can't be affectionate with other men in public if I want to be. And I'm part of being gay means that I can do that and I will do that. But I can't do that anywhere else. I can do it at the Castro Street Fair, but I couldn't go out into District 8. I couldn't go out into District 8 hand-in-hand with somebody, with another man. I couldn't go out in District 8 hugging another man. I walk down the street there. Sometimes I go out there to visit my parents, and I'm walking up Mission Street, and somebody will yell out of their car, "Faggot," at me. And I'm just walking up the street.
I'm not in opposition at all to what Robert says, and I think that the things that as a human being, the that he wants to express, again, are there's nothing wrong with affection. I think that there is a segment that goes beyond that, which is call it good taste. I don't know if good taste exists in the world anymore.
But isn't that your good taste as opposed to the good taste of the people who live in the neighborhood? And isn't this every movement seems to develop or go through a ghetto period, which is probably represented best in the gay movement by Castro Street or Christopher Street in New York. And that the ghetto mentality will breed what appear to be, to the outside, excesses, but which are in fact a necessary cultural manifestation along the road to developing a culture that's distinct and unique. And yet,
I come from a society of from the 50s that men didn't cry.
Have you ever felt deprived by not being able to cry when you wanted to?
Oh, I cry now. I've learned to cry. I've learned not to to put on the macho airs. There has been the human rights movement has given me a freedom that I never had before. It's hard to explain it when you're walking with your family. You have a young daughter with you. I don't like to take my daughter into an R-rated movie and hear some of the language that is common. It offends me. It embarrasses me.
Well, maybe then in a multicultural city, what we need to do is have some kind of like an R-rated movie. We could have zoning, that we have adult entertainment zones or neighborhoods. I mean, certainly the Castro Street Fair has a carnival atmosphere. It's a time and a place where I don't think, although you might be offended by the behavior you describe, because you're coming from a different cultural milieu, you certainly shouldn't have been surprised at seeing it there and then.
Well, again, the fair was neat. I enjoyed looking at the wares and the salesmen, and there was good things going on. There was the Dunk Diane tank, and I was laughing at those things and enjoying. And there was a lot of political people. Even Quentin Cobb was standing there in the corner, and you could walk up to him and talk to him and things. And I thought it was open, but again, there was a segment that went beyond what I would consider taste. I don't know how to put it without alienating and making people angry, but that's how I feel.
It quite clearly went beyond your taste, and it seems not to.
Yes,
as
he said, he was a child of the 50s and he has those cultural values. I'm a child of the 70s, and I come from culturally where in my neighborhood you can be a sissy and be proud of it.
And that's a good note to bring to a conclusion this father-son interview with Robert Barnes Jr., who is 20 today, this morning on Sunday, August 26th, and with Bob Barnes, labor leader, formerly an opponent, ran against Dan White, 1977. Thank you both very much for being here. It's been an enlightening and exciting interview.
Thanks for having us, Randy.
Okay, we're talking to Pat Norman, who is the coordinator of gay services for the Center for Special Problems in San Francisco. Good morning, Pat.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. You did last week an in-service training for school administrators in San Francisco that was the outgrowth of the May 25th, 1977 school board resolution about sensitization to gay lifestyles. Is that right?
Right.
First of all, why did it take 21 months to begin the implementation?
That's a really difficult question.
27 months, actually.
We have a lot of reasons that we've heard about, such as Proposition 13 and different priorities, basically. There's been a lot of difficulty getting money for programs. So although the actual writing up of the new curriculum that includes gay lifestyles was done, it hasn't been able to be implemented yet. And I have no idea when that's going to take place.
So you and another counselor finally got a chance to talk to school administrators last week. Is that right?
Right.
That was Scott Worth?
Scott Worth from Operation Concern.
Okay, what did it consist of? What did you have to tell them about gay lifestyles?
Well, actually, it was a general overview, and we talked about our concern about violence against gays, against gay students and gay teachers and children of gays and gay parents and the gay community in general. And that what we wanted to get across to them was their responsibility in that kind of violence, that because of their own sometimes misinformation and judgments, moral judgments that come from our conditioning, from the state and from the church and from the law, that they themselves carry around a lot of biases that in a whole lot of different ways affect how their students respond to different minority groups.
Was it mainly you? Excuse me.
Was it the myths that the general population has about gay people? And we talked about what's real about gay people in the gay community. And we talked about the needs of students in school, which is programming, creative, effective programming that, in fact, will lead to people not being bored, so that what they have to do in their off time is to go and beat up on people.
How did these administrators respond? Did they have lots of questions, or did they just sit there silently?
Well, let me first tell you that Peter Meese, who's the president of the Board of Education, or the Board of whatever they are, commissioners,
right,
as well as Eugene Hopp, also gave a very short presentation and spoke to the challenge that was going to be the administrators this coming year and asked for their assistance in changing the attitudes of the students.
Overall, do you think it went well for a first session?
Our feedback to this point is that that it did go well, that people were able to hear us, and that in some kind of ways most of the people there were interested in hearing what we had to say. It was the first time ever that we've been able to speak to the school administrators, as you mentioned before.
Will you have more chances in the future to talk to the school administrators?
Yes, we probably will be given support for doing in-services with administrators as well as with some of the teaching staff, so that they have a better idea of how to present major issues of the gay community to their students.
So you still actually haven't had the chance to talk to the teachers who teach family life education.
Right. You know, there is a gay teachers organization here, and Tom Ammiano and Hank Wilson have been very, very active in that organization, as well as a few other people, other teachers, gay teachers. And they've been working on this for several years through the Youth Committee, Youth and Education Committee of the Human Rights Commission, so that they, at this point, will probably be in communication with the administration to set up further in-services. We do have the support of the school board at this point, it seems. We do have the support of Peter Meese and of Eugene Hopp and Jules Johnson and Myra Kopp, who was also present yesterday morning. And so we do have a basis at this point for being able to present that kind of stuff.
Okay. Thank you very much, Pat Norman. Sure. Well, that just about wraps it up on The Gay Life this morning. I'd like to remind you of a production by the San Francisco Lesbian and Gay History Project called Lesbian Masquerade, Some Lesbians in Early San Francisco Who Passed as Men, a talk with slides by Alan Berube. That's at 8 o'clock this Wednesday, August 29th, at the Women's Building, 3543 18th Street, San Francisco, a $2 donation to benefit the San Francisco Lesbian and Gay History Project. That's at the Women's Building, 8 o'clock this Wednesday, on 18th Street between Valencia and Guerrero in San Francisco. The Gay Life is co-produced by Fred Green and myself, Randy Alfred. If you want to hear what I have to say about Charles McCabe, you can read it this week in the San Francisco Sentinel or in the Berkeley Barb. If you're listening to the show on Sunday morning, it runs again on Monday night at 1 a.m., so please tell a friend about The Gay Life on KSAN San Francisco.